You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudet. Idaho comes in fifth in the nation for children who experienced more than three traumatic experiences in their life. This is according to a 2014 study of adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. Types of ACEs include abuse, neglect, or dysfunction in the home, things like substance abuse, maybe divorce, violence, or incarceration. The Idaho Youth Ranch and the Idaho Children's Trust Fund are hoping awareness will change the domino effect of childhood trauma later in life. A 1997 study by Kaiser Permanente and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that if childhood trauma is not managed right, it could lead to choices as an adult that will take a toll on society. Early traumas can follow a child into adulthood in the form of health problems, substance abuse, financial issues. This study, which is now more than 20 years old, was the first of its kind that looked at 17,000 participants. And they looked at their health, as well as the social and economic effects of adverse childhood experiences over their lifetime. The study looked at the history of abuse, family dysfunction, and current health status. It was the first study to ask the question, what happened to you, instead of focusing on what's wrong with you. Today, we will be spending the next hour delving into this complex issue to see what's being done here in Idaho to change the course of children affected by ACEs and what more needs to be done. If you want to join in the conversation, you can send us an email right now at idahomatters@boisestate.edu or tweet us at KBSX915. Joining me live in studio to start this conversation about what ACEs is are Jane Zink with the Idaho Association for the Education of Young Children and from the Idaho Children's Trust Fund, Roger Sherman and Taryn Yates. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gemma.
I know that was a long introduction, but I think it was necessary for people to understand what we're talking about. So, Roger, I want to start with you. I talked a little bit about ACEs, but really explain what that term truly is.
So, like you said, I mean, adverse childhood experiences are based on a study that was done in the late 90s. That focuses around the impact of three categories of things, child abuse, child neglect, and serious family dysfunctions, divorce, suicidality, other kinds of mental health issues and so on in the household. And the study really was mind-blowing, I think, for the researchers, because what they found in it was that the impacts of it were long-term. That they were looking at people who had experienced ACEs up to 50 years later, but people were holding stress in their bodies, toxic stress, that were causing long-term health and behavioral problems. And those problems, manifested themselves all throughout their life course unless they're resolved in some other way.
And then you think about how even 20, 30 years ago, we didn't talk about things like this. We didn't talk about child sexual abuse, molestation, things like that that fall into that. So was that part of the study as well? Was all of a sudden this idea of we don't even discuss this?
Well, that's why the researchers were saying, this is the most important study that you've never heard about, because in a lot of ways what it did was it raised all of these issues that are really unfortunately well-kept secrets or among families and so on, and that this gives the opportunity for us to start talking about some things that are really important in people's lives. And we know that that can change the course, frankly, of history. I mean, it can change the way in which we all live in our community.
How widespread would you say this is in Idaho? Maybe Jane or Taryn, you can answer that question.
You might be able to handle the... I will say, so the interesting thing about the Kaiser Permanente study is that it was roughly 18,000 people, and these are all sort of middle-income white people, for the most part, who have insurance. And what they found was that ACEs are incredibly common. So if that population is having ACEs at such a high rate, and maybe we have it written down... what's that experience going to be like for people who have additional stress on their life, people from low-income families, people from neighborhoods that might be less safe?
And Jane, that kind of falls into what you do with the education of young children in Idaho, in the sense that a lot of times, these are children who come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. I mean, this is why we look at the idea of, need for pre-K, being funded, because that... these are a lot of the children that maybe are being overlooked when we talk about ACEs?
Well, ACEs cut across all right. socioeconomic backgrounds, but anytime children can experience a positive, nurturing, safe environment, whether it's in pre-K or any other childcare mm-hmm. setting or at home, I mean, that's our opportunity to help, to recognize and help children heal from the trauma that they've experienced. Because in Idaho, we know that Idaho children are experiencing traumatic experiences at a high rate. And this isn't something that's abstract. It's not happening in other states or in other cities. It's happening in every single community in Idaho. And so we have an opportunity then to think about what we can do in our schools and in our systems and just in our mm-hmm. communities to support children in their healing and their recognition of ACEs.
I think you make a good point in the idea that it's giving them that safe environment, because it doesn't affect just the child
correct.
That is experiencing this, correct?
Right. These ACEs happen in a system, right, in a family system or in a community system. And so when we address the ACEs of an individual, we really can heal a whole system. And that has ripple effects, because as the family heals and the community heals, then it becomes easier to address these mm-hmm. issues on a larger scale.
And Roger, talk about what Jane just said about this idea of addressing this and helping the family heal, because we have been very, and when I say we, I mean as a society, I think as a culture, yes. every system that is in place from government, even to schools in the past, it was a reactive. It was, let's try to fix it on the back end. But this is where the Idaho Children's Trust Foundation and the Idaho Youth Ranch and all of your partners come into play.
Right. So we know that the way that we can really change this is to change it, you know, with the parents. I mean, we're really interested in preventing ACEs from occurring in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so the extent we can do that, it's by helping the parents to heal so that when they have children, that they can, that those children grow up in a more safe and stable and nurturing environment than they did. And so that, you know, we, in the long term, we're really focusing on that whole family rather than just the, just the child.
And, you know, one of the things that you and I had spoken before this was this idea of giving parents more resources. Because right now how things are set up is that if you are taking a parenting course, you're usually the people who have been basically told by the judicial system that in order to maybe get your children back or you know, situations like that, you have to take these parenting classes.
So this is my, you know, this is my big soapbox, is we got to make parenting classes cool, right? We got to make it something that all of us feel like we need to, you know, we want to do, because it's going to give us the best opportunity to raise our kids in the best environment possible. My kids are in the midst right now of taking driver's ed, and you know, there's so much time spent on learning how to drive and so on, which I'm glad about. But you know, we spend not that much time, you know, learning how to be the best parents we can be. And if we could do that, and we could do it with our friends, and we could do it with our community and our family, I mean, I think we'd all enjoy mm-hmm. that more. But unfortunately, it becomes this mandatory thing that people are mandated from the courts, and then nobody wants to do it because it's not cool.
Right.
And I so agree with that. I mean, I've said, you know, just kind of in passing before that, you know, I remember being sent home with my first child right. from the hospital and being like, do you all think this is a good idea? I mean, do you honestly think this is the best idea? And truly, and I take that from the standpoint of, here is a person who I have every advantage.
Mm-hmm.
It is still the hardest thing. And it is still, you still don't know what you're doing. And Taryn, you've talked about this before. Then you take it for someone who doesn't have that kind of support.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny. I think I had a 9-month-old when I started this job. And so I'm learning all these things and I'm still completely overwhelmed. And I'm someone, you know, who has resources mm-hmm. and even skills and knowledge. So even when you have all these supports, parenting is still the hardest job you'll ever love, like they say. So what can we do for parents that don't have access to the resources and support and skill set and knowledge that they really need to help their children thrive?
And we have a couple of questions from listeners that I do want to quickly get to. And if you are interested in joining the conversation, you can email us at idahomatters@boisestate.edu, or you can tweet us at KBSX915. This comes from Jennifer in Boise. She's actually a social worker. And so she says, she said, you know, she's in the midst of the struggle with this right now. But she wants to know how we can advocate more effectively to department leaders and to the legislature to receive additional funding for more child welfare social workers, as well as supportive services for families, because she goes on to say they burn out.
Mm-hmm. And we're fully supportive of this. And fortunately, you're going to have some folks from Boise School District who will be here to talk about it.
Right.
And we've been so impressed with some of the work that's going on in the community schools and trying to really engage the community more in these efforts around becoming more trauma-informed, around providing parent education, around creating some supports for their concrete needs like food and other kinds of mm-hmm. things, so that the school takes on a role of helping to support the parents in the community. Now, the legislature needs to hear that more, and so I would just really encourage people to be talking to them about that. I think we're gonna do our work. I think all of us who you'll hear from today are wanting to do our work to talk to the legislators about this, to help them understand what, as you said earlier, in the past we just never dealt with. So if we can focus more on these things that we know now are true and that are scientifically shown to be impactful, we can make all of our systems mm-hmm. better. We can make our education system better. We can, we can provide teachers with the tools they need to help both the parents and the kids.
And before we go into break, you used a term, trauma-informed. And I want you all to kind of explain this terminology, because this is something that, you know, if you are within the system that you work in, you understand the term. But these are terms that maybe some people may not be familiar with.
You want to do it?
Jane?
Sure.
So trauma-informed, how would we explain that term?
Trauma-informed means that understanding or acknowledging that all people or most people have traumatic events in their life, and sometimes that affects the way that they behave and the way they respond to events. And understanding, being informed and being empathetic and understanding how to respond in a way so that when we see a behavior that is really trauma-based, mm-hmm. we respond in a way that is healing and not in a way that compounds the trauma for the person who's already experienced it. And it's a big ask, because it can feel like a little maybe like weakness or like we're capitulating to someone, but it's a way of responding that is based in empathy and in understanding and in a growth mindset, understanding what that person needs and that we have the capacity to provide it.
I'm going to be bringing the three of you back at the end of the program to actually talk more about HOPE and what that acronym means and how we move forward with this. So I want to thank the three of you right now. My guest in this segment, Jane Zink with the Idaho Association for the Education of Young Children, and from the Idaho Children's Trust, Roger Sherman and Taryn Yates. Up next, we're going to look at the impacts of childhood trauma on health, on behavior, but in particular, on suicide. And remember, if you have a comment or a question for our panel today, email us at idahomatters@boisestate.edu or tweet us, KBSX915. I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We are continuing our discussion about ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences. Types of ACEs include abuse, neglect, or dysfunction in the home, things that could be substance abuse, divorce, violence, or incarceration. And these experiences in childhood can carry over into adulthood. Joining me live in studio to talk more about the impacts of childhood trauma on health, on behavior, and in particular on suicide, our Dr. Tom Patterson. He is an area pediatrician, and retired Judge Jack Varen with the Speedy Foundation and the Idaho Coalition to Prevent Suicide. Welcome to the program, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, so I would like to just start with, if you could tell me maybe, Dr. Patterson, what are some of the specific impacts that you've seen on health when we talk about how this impacts someone's health?
Yeah, I think my whole training has come unwound as I look at ACEs. And, you know, if you look at ACEs, adverse childhood events can disrupt neurodevelopment that leads to social, emotional, cognitive, developmental impairment. And then as a response, kids and adolescents will adapt or adopt health risk behaviors, and then those lead to disease, disability, and developmental problems, social problems, and can even lead to early death. And so, you know, if you look at this, adverse childhood events have a massive neurophysiologic and hormonal response in our body. I love Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris's analogy with the bear in the woods. We meet the bear in the woods. All of these things happen in our body to either protect us or to fight the bear off, fight or flight. If that bear comes home to live with you, you have that neurohormonal response every single day of your life, every moment of your existence, and that's maladaptive.
And you've seen this in your practice, I am assuming.
Absolutely.
And have you seen things get better over time, or are the number of children remain the same? Does that make sense?
So I'm an infant in the screening process. Mm-hmm. This is all new to me. I'm growing in my knowledge of this every day. I started screening rather spontaneously upon a clinical need that I saw one night in clinic. And it was a child who, at age 7, I had done an evaluation as we would using normal algorithms for diagnosis of attention deficit disorder. It diagnosed her, discussed treatment options, started her on treatment for ADHD. At age 8, I discovered that she had endured a tragic situation in her own home. This was one of the worst adverse childhood events I had ever witnessed, hearing about. And so I stopped ADHD meds, got her into counseling. She no longer qualifies for ADHD diagnostic criteria.
Wow.
That's huge.
That's huge. So, Judge Barron, you were also a juvenile court judge in the Magic Valley for 13 years.
Correct.
Before we get into you being with the Speedy Foundation and the Coalition to Prevent Suicide, tell me about what you saw within the juvenile system.
In the juvenile system, we saw what Dr. Patterson was just talking about. The kids coming in with severe behavior problems, and they'd harm somebody. I had done something that brought the attention of the courts, the prosecutors, to them. And so we had many children in. We dealt with a lot of sex offending behavior. And as we dealt with that, we got to find out that many of the children who were engaged in that, who had suffered that, were also engaged in that.
They were victims of it.
They were victims of it, as well as then perpetrating on others, too. And throughout our experience with children in other areas, we just knew that something was going on that we couldn't get our handle around because we didn't really understand ACEs. I've known about ACEs for a period of time because it came out in the 90s. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of that is we knew about it, but we didn't know what to do about it. And the courts were in that same position, too. I mean, we have limited capabilities as judges to really be effectual, and it takes a lot of efforts from the community. And in many ways, we're the least capable, in my view, the least capable entity to be able to address this issue. And yet we have to address this issue because the community needs to be kept safe. And so it created a lot of conflict within the court system and trying to come up with the services. The juvenile court judges were always antsy to try to go out and find the services that could help these problems and address these issues. I have no idea of the number of cases that were actually full ACEs cases, but I know now that a great many of them were, and that impacted our capability of really being successful.
So then talk to me about how you believe suicide and suicide prevention relate to ACEs, because we have a serious problem here in Idaho.
We have a very serious problem, and in my view, from the little that I've been able to understand and experience and whatnot, childhood trauma is a very significant impact, and the studies have indicated now that are going out there that there's a correlation. Now, to say, is it the only correlation? Mm-hmm. No. Suicide is a very complex subject. There's all sorts of things going in. Into it. But as Tom described earlier, all these factors that are coming through our understanding of ACEs now are things that that contribute to that, the fear that's involved with this, the lack of control. A child, my experience working with these kids, they don't have any control at all. And either flee or flight or freeze. And I had a lot of kids just freeze. Mm. They were not receptive to anything. And in that case, you have to be really worried that if they're not amenable to almost anything, then with what's going on in their mind? And likely that's leading them to think about thoughts of, let's not do this.
Well, let's get out of the situation the only way we know how.
Correct.
And to have control over the situation.
Correct.
I have a question from a listener, Sue, and she says, do you think training in trauma-informed care would have avoided our needing legislation to turn a state hospital basically into a lockdown place? Maybe.
I'd like to take a shot at that.
Okay.
The answer is just simply yes.
There you go.
In my view. That's
in your
my
view,
experience.
Like plain and simple, in your view. Dr. Patterson, you talked about screening and when you were talking about this example of this 7-year-old little girl. Talk to me about the screening plan that we'll be rolling out in the spring and what this is.
So we work on learning collaboratives where we have physicians who take care of children, both family docs, pediatricians, and nurse practitioners, and advanced practice providers that will be joining the collaborative. Currently, we have 10 that span the entire state. We have funding from Maternal Child Health that allows us to go statewide. We appreciate that so much. We'll be looking at increasing education, screening, and referral for those that have positive ACE scores in the population from 9 months to 5 years of age. We anticipate that this will be a 9 to 12 month learning collaborative. We're excited about it. It involves not just the care provider, but their entire office staff. We'll be doing coaching in the offices to help them become trauma-informed. We'll as well be doing monthly webinars throughout the entire time of the collaborative to increase the knowledge for adverse childhood events and what we can do in response to build resiliency in children so that we can reduce the impact of adverse childhood events.
So will this be with this screening, will then any child that comes in be screened?
The idea of that, in addition to all the other screens we do in a 20-minute visit, is very overwhelming to the current provider pool. What we're doing to get our feet wet and get into this, get some champions created across the state is we're having them look at the first 20 patients that come in in a week, and we'll be surveying those patients to see whether they are screening or not, and if there's a positive, whether those get referred. Mm-hmm. The ultimate goal is to be universal trauma-informed, universal screeners, and universal resiliency builders.
And I want to talk a little bit more about this before we go into a break to both of you, is about the importance of prevention, but also this idea of resiliency, right? And not just within the child. Does it have to come within the family as well, within that dynamic?
Yes, and resiliency really is prevention. If we can help families before they come into the system develop a resiliency, then that's true prevention. Interventions really, frankly, aren't that successful at this level. So really, it's going to take a community to come together to figure out how to help all of us actually deal with this. Because this isn't, we talk about it in terms of these difficult behaviors, but this is endemic in our community. And one of the things I was really excited about, frankly, and I don't mean to be political, but the city of Boise's Be Kind. I mean, that's what it's going to take is a cultural change for this to happen. And that will build resiliency because one of the major elements, I think the doctor would agree on, is social support. And we need to have that. We need to have mindfulness. And we need to then engage the families and the communities in positive activities. Exercise is important. Exercising the body that's tied up with all the trauma that's occurred in its life. The body keeps score. Helping that body be made well by exercise and other things is important. So I think that's what prevention needs to focus on is not just on it needs to be a global kind of a thing and working with the community as a whole.
Well, and it's interesting because when Roger was just in the last segment, he talked about this idea of parenting classes, right?
Correct.
And as a judge, I am sure that you had to tell people that they had to go to parenting classes. Yet, I don't believe there's probably any parent who wouldn't have found some benefit to a parenting course at some point, Would you agree with that, Dr. Patterson?
Absolutely. Again, pediatrician care, pediatric care is all around prevention. So I agree with that. But we find ourselves in a situation where we do have to intervene, and you can build resiliency. Part of that is positive parenting, teaching. By screening parents, we can understand better what their needs are as parents. Sometimes it's as simple as the parent identifying, I'm not broken. Something's happened to me. And then we can coach them on how they can use their strengths and minimize the impact of their weaknesses on their own parenting. And many parents, as I look back over the years, I think I knew they had high A scores. I didn't call them that. And my response to that was building parenting skills that were positive, modeling how to love a kid in the office. I think we can build resiliency through good nutrition, good sleep, exercise, relationships, building relationships. If you look at the social determinants of health, relationships that are healthy are the number one social determinant of health.
I want to thank both of you for coming in and talking specifically about health and behaviors and suicide and how all of this plays into ACEs. My guest during this segment, pediatrician Dr. Tom Patterson and retired Judge Jack Farron, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Next, we will look at the impact of childhood trauma on a student's ability to learn and to develop both socially and emotionally. And if you would like to join the conversation, make sure you email us your comments or questions right now at idahomatters@boisestate.edu or tweet us, KBSX 91.5. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. You are listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We are continuing our discussion about ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences. And as you might imagine, these experiences can roll over into the classroom and the learning environment. Joining me live in studio to talk about the impact of childhood trauma on a student's ability to learn and to develop both socially and emotionally are Mark Jones with the Boise School District, Tamara Venegas with the Boise School District, and Cecily Heath, Director of Clinical at the Idaho Youth Ranch. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I want to just start with how you would say ACEs affects behavior within a classroom.
You can take
that one, Tamara.
So I think that what's important to remember is that children are individuals, and the trauma experiences that children have are different as well. So it depends on the child and the trauma experience. Several guests have already talked about fight, flight, or freeze. We see all three of those. Some children show rage to the point that they level a classroom, pulling down bookshelves, throwing chairs, all of those kinds of things. Some students, they don't want to be noticed. They freeze. They want to be in the background. They don't want anybody to notice who they are or what they're wearing, what their answers may or may not be. And other children freeze. They don't even come to school. So we get a variety of responses in the classroom from children who've experienced early childhood trauma.
And Cecily?
Yeah, I'd love to contribute to that just a little bit in that one of the things that I think is important to recognize is that when children are developing, the frontal lobe, or the area that really helps them control behavior, is one of the last things that develops. And for kids who are really in environments where they're experiencing lots of ACEs, their brain is devoting all of the energy they have simply to surviving. And as such, when they finally arrive in the school, they're arriving at a deficit because they've lacked a lot of that frontal lobe development that would be expected developmentally for their age. And so when they're being asked to sit and pay attention and all of those things, and they're actually oftentimes physically incapable of doing that. And then oftentimes in school, we have punitive ways of dealing with those behaviors instead of restorative ways of dealing with those behaviors, which actually contributes to the re-traumatization of kids in the classroom. So.
And we have a question from a listener that I wanted to ask the three of you, because it's about education. This comes from Sue, and she says, trauma-informed care, how would you like to see professionals use it at public institutions like K-12? And Tamara, you're a trained trauma counselor, correct?
Yes. Right. So we in the Boise District are trying to move from trauma-informed to trauma-skilled. Mm. And I think that what Cecily said is so profound. In the past, we used to use punishment
or consequences. Mark and I went to a trauma conference last year called Hope for the Wounded. And one of the quotes that was given there that we're trying to take into our school district as we train education professionals is, if you want to work with wounded students, you have to suspend judgment. You can't consequence children out of their wounds. You have to teach them. Yeah. And in teaching them, there has to be love and there has to be boundaries. Those relationships have to be solid when those children come into those classrooms if we're going to help them move past those wounds.
And Mark, I was reading about in the state of Illinois where one of the things within their public school system, what they have done is stop taking certain punishments away, in the sense of, like, with small children, you know, it used to be you take your recess away, right? And what they were finding is, it goes back to exactly what Tamara was saying, is this idea of the punishment doesn't necessarily work. Are you finding that within your school district?
Yes, it's definitely something we need to be conscious of and working all the time. And as Tamara mentioned earlier, Joe Hendershot talks about all the time that if you want to work with kids, again, you can't consequence them out. You have to sometimes put the rule book away. So it doesn't mean that we still don't hold kids accountable for misbehavior. But if we don't give them hope, if we don't instill within them that we care about them, they're going to miss all of that. And so what we have to do with our teachers, and one thing, too, is, like, the teachers in this valley are our heroes, because we're asking them to teach, to read and write, right, and do all these academic skills and critical thinking, and now they're dealing with trauma. So I just want to give a big shout out to all the teachers in this valley and the great job that they do. And I think what we're starting to see with our teachers is each day that they come in, they give those children hope. And one thing that Rita Pearson says is, she says that every child deserves a champion, and our teachers are those champions for those students. And when they give that hope to those kids, that goes a long way from some of the consequences that we can give them, the positive reinforcement, mm-hmm, and avoid some of those immediate consequences.
Well, and Jane, in the very first segment today, made a very good point about, especially if you have a child within your school system who is experiencing ACEs within the home, school may be the one place,
yes,
where they feel safe.
Yes, that's very true. And I loved hearing Jane say that, because one of the problems that we have forgotten in the past, but we now know, as we know better, we do better, is that when our children come into the classrooms in the morning, they're oftentimes not ready to learn. Many of these children that have experienced trauma at home have just left a volatile home. Mm. They walk into our classroom, we can't just pull out the math book and start teaching math. We need to give those children time to transition. They need time to breathe. They need time to calm down. They need time to become present before they can actually learn. We're helping them move from their amygdala into their prefrontal cortex.
And Cecily, at the Idaho Youth Ranch, I mean, your organization deals with kids who have experienced, I mean, significant trauma in their lives. So how does your organization address, you know, ACEs when you're working with these kiddos?
Yeah, I think there's a variety of ways. The first way is that organizationally we're becoming trauma-informed. And so everyone in the organization is receiving 16-plus hours of trauma-informed care training, because we're only as trauma-informed as our least trauma-informed employee. And that includes our thrift and all of the other different programs that we have. I would say that's big picture. As far as individually, one of the examples I have is Hayes House. So Hayes House is a shelter for runaway homeless youth and youth who are otherwise struggling in their home environment. And what we're able to provide there is a stable living environment with nurturing caregivers that are predictable. All of those things are very important in establishing safety for youth. We have transportation that's provided to keep them in their school of origin to make sure that we're not actually contributing to the list of ACEs that kids are coming in with. We have evidence-based and evidence-inspired innovative therapies that we're offering. So we recognize, and many of us have alluded to this already, that trauma isn't necessarily accessible through the frontal lobe, right? So through being able to talk about it. And oftentimes by the time kids land at our doorstep, they've already been through multiple therapists and through multiple therapies and talked enough about their problems and haven't seen a lot of therapeutic gains, haven't seen a lot of benefit in their life in a real way. So we offer services such as eye movement desensitization reintegration. So that's EMDR therapy, which a lot of people are familiar with. Trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm trained in somatic experiencing, which is a body-based method for addressing trauma. We also have equine-assisted psychotherapy, which is a pretty neat program that allows for kids to experientially work through a lot of what they've gone through. And So a lot of innovative ways of addressing ACEs.
You know, it's interesting. In the very beginning of the program, I spoke about this study by Kaiser Permanente and the CDC back in 1997, which was kind of this groundbreaking study. And what I read about it was they said it was the first time that within a research study that they said what happened to you versus what is wrong with you.
Yep.
How important is that to remember within the educational environment?
So I'm so glad you asked that question. So I've spent, before I'm in my current role in the district, I've spent over 30 years as a principal and teacher in the district. And so in my younger years, I'd always ask why a child did something. And of course, they shrug their shoulders and they don't know why.
Well, I don't know.
That's like it's a, and that like is a legitimate response. So it's not asking why, it's asking what can I do to help you? Mm. What things can I do to provide in your life right now, in your situation, they're going to help you through your current struggle or whatever, conflict or whatever it is. So I know it's intuitive that we think we always want to ask why a child does something. It just doesn't work. We have to ask what, and what can we do to give you the love and the support and the encouragement and that positive atmosphere to make you successful.
And Cecily?
Yeah, I just think underneath every single behavior is a need. That's what behavior is them expressing a need. And so asking what the need is and responding to the need rather than punishing or acknowledging the behavior, we end up with a lot more gains that way. And it helps move from this idea of I can't for kids in education to building competency and mastery and shifting to this idea of I can, which is important in resiliency.
And let's talk a little bit about that, because that is that mindfulness mindset, which as a parent, I am so incredibly thankful that it's being taught in my children's school. I do my best to do it, but we all know as parents, it is hard to remember that. How important is it, especially when we're talking with kids who are dealing with ACEs, about mindfulness, about resiliency, about teaching them these behaviors?
Well, I think it's key. We have to, and mistakes, I think that somebody said something about making mistakes. I want to go back to that. There's so much shame in saying that you made mistakes or did it wrong, that when we talk about mindsets and mind growth and changing that, one of the things we teach children to say is things like, I don't have it yet. Mm-hmm. But those mistakes are good because I'm trying and I'm learning. So you build that confidence in those children while they're learning. In addition to that, I would like to go back to what Mark was saying about what adults can do. And I think, Cecily, I think you hit on it already, is those adults have got to be consistent. Mm-hmm. They have to be predictable. And they have to be loving. So if we're working with children as they're changing their mindsets in a loving, persistent, and predictable way, then that helps build confidence in them, knowing that they can go out into the world and do things successfully.
And I have a question from a listener before we wrap up. This just came in from Margaret in Boise. She says, my son is in the juvenile justice system because of a misunderstanding of his disability at school, even though he has an IEP, behavioral support program, and is in the Excel program in a Boise junior high school. When are we going to see this understanding of trauma that your school district guests seem to have when it comes to that trickle down to the front lines?
Well, it's a legitimate concern that was just expressed by that listener, but it is also a journey. It does take time. This is something that's relatively new as far as the impact and the intensity of what our kids are facing. Mm-hmm. And I had mentioned earlier about, you know, the 3 R's that we have to do with kids and then adding this trauma. So I want to give the listeners hope that we really can and will do better, but it is a process and it takes time as we educate. And so we do a lot of that through constant mindfulness training, resiliency training, and giving teachers the tools to give their kids. And so it's something that we are totally committed to. And then real quick, I know that Tam and I represent Boise, but I want the listeners to know that in this valley, CUNA School District and Caldwell and West Ada.
I'm glad you brought that up because there are many school districts.
They are doing an amazing job.
Yeah.
And every listener should be so pleased with what the school districts are doing. They're doing an amazing job. And I have friends and colleagues in all of those districts that surround there. And they are doing incredible things for our students.
I want to thank the three of you for coming in today. My guest today, Mark Jones and Tamara Venegas with the Boise School District and Cecily Heath with the Idaho Youth Wrench. Up next, can we make a difference? How do we do that? I'll look at hope. I'm Gemma Gaudet. You're listening to Idaho Matters. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We have been spending this hour discussing ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences. My guests are from the first segment are back. Taryn Yates and Roger Sherman with the Idaho Children's Trust Fund, and Jane Zink is joining me. And I really want to get to the point that ACEs does not determine who you will become. Correct, Roger?
It's so important for us to understand that ACEs are not destiny. They're not your fate. They are something to know about yourself. I think that can be very powerful, but it's really, our abilities to change, our ability to, to become something other than what we, what the ACEs might tell us is just, it just happens over and over and over again. And so when we resolve those issues, people can move forward. They can build their resiliency. They can develop the kind of healthy social connections that make it possible for them to live well.
And I have a question from a listener, Stephanie, and she says, in Minnesota, there were early child and family education courses offered to everybody who had children aged younger than kindergarten. It was a parenting course with other parents from your community who had similar age children. Parents spent an hour with a parent educator. They talked about parenting issues, and the children spent time together separately socializing. She said it was a fabulous way to provide education and support to everyone. Could Idaho do the same thing? Jane?
We would love it if Idaho would do the same thing, because there's such an odd stigma, not just in Idaho, but around our country, around parenting education. It's like
we're supposed to know, right?
Right. We stigmatize it, even though there are a million other things that we don't know what we're doing. And there's classes available for everyone without any kind of stigma. So it's really important to reclaim the narrative about parenting education and understand that parents get conflicting information mm-hmm. all the time. From everything about how we should feed our children to how we should discipline them.
And there's shame around it, too, if you
shame.
Don't do it the way some
right.
people think you should do it. I want to talk about Hope Conquering ACEs, Taryn. Tell us what this is.
Yeah, so in kind of a response to just how important adverse childhood experiences are and how everyone should know this, we created Hope Conquers ACEs. The HOPE stands for Health Outcomes from Positive Experiences. And this is based on, I don't want to take the credit for it, a report from Bob Segay et al. So, and what he found was, all these, just the impact of positive experiences, of having the social connections, of sitting around eating dinner together. So we, the Idaho Children's Trust Fund has been funded by the Blue Cross Foundation to go out into the community, and we created a community of practice with 25 trainers from all over the state who have been trained on this material, who are trained on ACEs and the trauma-informed approach and brain development, to go out into their communities and train at all levels. Basically, anyone who works with children and families needs to know this information, right? That's our vision, an entire culture shift into this approach. So we're just kind of step by step out there training. We're working with schools, like you've heard, hospitals, nonprofit organizations.
The judicial system.
The judicial system. I mean, at every single level, they're, even parks and recreation. Have their staff. This is useful information for them. So that's where we're at. We're still in our first year. We've trained
over 1,500 people statewide
wow.
since the beginning of since January last year, and that's been in a whole bunch of different venues and schools and in public programs and conferences and childcare centers and the whole range of different groups, both professionals and parents and, others who we know have impact on families' lives.
And are we seeing this across the country in other states? Are we able to take from what other states are doing?
Definitely. I mean, there's work that, We are definitely the beneficiaries of understanding that, what other states are doing in all kinds of areas. I mean, we've been doing this quite a while, though, actually. I mean, Jane and I have been doing this for, I think, a dozen years or so, mm-hmm. been talking about this stuff. And finally, now it's time to shout it from the rooftops so everybody can hear it.
And final question for each of you. What would be the one takeaway for a listener, maybe someone who isn't within the system we've talked about, who is being trained on this, but what do we need to know as a society, as a community?
Each one of us has a role. I mean, this is not going to be solved by one person or one group or anything, but all of us have a role to play. And a lot of it is, you know, like Judge Varin talked about, you know, with the Kindness Initiative or other kinds of things that really just create an environment where kids can thrive and we can not put the shame on parents. We can be that supportive person, you know, for the people close to us and for our neighbors and for the person we see in Winco struggling to, you know, get their kid through the grocery line.
Jane?
I would say never underestimate the power of your personal relationship that's kind and supportive, because that is, relationship in and of itself is healing.
And Taryn?
I would say that this is possible, that this change is possible, that healing is possible, and prevention is possible.
I want to thank all of my guests, the three of you, all of my other guests who have been here today. Such a critical conversation for us to be having and for our listeners to be hearing. And I want to thank all of my guests today, all of our listeners as well, who participated in the conversation. I do appreciate you giving us those questions and comments. So thank you all today for coming in and talking about this.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. As always, my producers, Samantha Wright and Richard Copeland, associate producers, Hannah Gardosky. I'm Gemma Gaudet. You've been listening to Idaho Matters. Have a great rest of your day, and we will see you back here tomorrow.